for you. It's time to play Truth or Consequences.
I don't know if any of you actually remember that radio turned television program, Truth or Consequences, but it did help to teach a very valuable life lesson. When you don't tell the truth, there are consequences. And in a much more serious way, we're going to take a look at that subject on this edition of Come Receive the Light.
God is truth. And when we speak truth, I think we connect with God.
God certainly has no trouble telling the truth. But we do, that's for sure.
Often, we're struggling even to articulate the truth about ourselves. Sometimes we want to express something and we're just not really sure what we're trying to say.
Speaking of saying things, I think you'll hear some things said during that conversation that I don't believe you've thought about before. That's our feature interview coming up a little bit later today.
So, of course, Israel, everything that it does, it uses it for its security. And my husband and I in the village of Taiba in the last 8 years, we worked very hard to show this different face of Palestine. Some of us are normal people there. Not all of us are terrorists.
That's Dr. Maria Khoury, and she's going to take us behind the news headlines we're hearing every single day. Welcome to another edition of Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network, a ministry out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We're also on the web. If you're hearing us on a radio station somewhere, at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. We're a nonprofit outreach, and you can listen again to any of our broadcasts and other resources, read them, view them, listen to them when you go to that website, myocn.net. Well, depending upon what news you watch, read, or listen to, and what part of the world you live in, you have a certain perspective, I'm sure, on what's going on in the Middle East, especially between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And today on our broadcast, we're going to tell one side of that story. Dr. Maria Khoury is an author and a speaker. She was born in Tripoli, Greece, and raised in Denver, Colorado. She and her husband are the parents of three adult children, and they divide their time these days between a home in Boston, Massachusetts, and Taiba, a Palestinian village in the West Bank. She travels throughout the world promoting her books and speaking about the dwindling Christian presence in Palestine. And Father Chris got her on the phone to talk about that particular subject.
Welcome, Maria. Nice to hear your voice again.
Thank you for having me on the program, Father Chris.
Let's talk about why this is such an important issue for you, and I would think then through you to our listeners.
Well, Father Chris, for myself, being a Greek Orthodox Christian graduate from Helena College, as a Greek person having met my husband, a Palestinian, at Helena College, and living there since 1995 in Palestine next to Israel, we live behind a huge big wall now that Israel has built, trying to promote our community to survive there because we're really being cleaned up from all the terrible checkpoints, the occupation, the wars that happened there. The Christian community is actually diminishing.
Mm-hmm. And so you would say that things have gotten better, worse, stagnant? What's the status at this point?
Well, since Israel built the huge wall, 26 feet high, and they finished building it in 2005, things constantly get worse because this wall is not up between two countries like most people think, but instead the wall completely closes in Bethlehem, for example, in the Ramallah area where Taiba is, where I live. It's another wall that closes that area. And up north in Jenin, we don't have a lot of Christians there, but the wall there closes that area. And so it's a bunch of different prison camps meant to make the communities not be able to go back and forth so freely. We need permits to get into Jerusalem. We have illegal Israeli settlements being built all around. I have three settlements closing in on Taiba. Bethlehem has more than 22 illegal settlements just closing in on Bethlehem. So it's very frustrating because the settlements are a huge, big obstacle to peace. They control all of the roads, the natural resources. For example, I don't have water in Taiba 5 days in the week. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we go without water. But the Jewish settlements get water 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So these are just huge, big injustices that are happening to Palestinian Christians and Muslims, but to all Palestinians.
And I'm sure that people on the other side of the fence, so to say, would say that these are justified because of what has been happening and the rockets and what have you that are coming over. I don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but I want to put the other hat on for a minute and say, is there some justification that the Israelis need to be protecting themselves too, do you think, from your perspective?
Well, for us as a Christian people and throughout the time of all Christian communities, we are nonviolent people and we're peaceful people. That's why also it's very important to keep Christian people in the Holy Land, because we follow the gospel of not just love your neighbor, but love your enemy. So we feel we have a very important place where conflict takes place. We want to be witnesses for Christ's love, for Christ's peace. So, of course, Israel, everything that it does, it uses it for its security. And my husband and I in the village of Taiba in the last 8 years, we worked very hard to show this different face of Palestine. Some of us are normal people there. Mm-hmm. Not all of us are terrorists. And
so
many,
the problem is coming from let's say, an extreme terrorist sort
of
situation.
We have in the Hamas group people that believe the country should be won back in a military way. Mm-hmm. In other words, in 1948, the glorious establishment of Israel was actually more than 500 Palestinian villages wiped from the face of the earth in massacres. And so one country's great glory is actually another country's great catastrophe, and more than 750,000 Palestinians were forced to leave their homes. So they felt, since Israel was established by fighting and war, that they too want to win back by using violence. We as Christian people promote nonviolent action. There's a lot of nonviolent action happening in different places now inside Israel and in Palestine, because we do want basic human rights for everyone. We want a country that is truly democratic.
Sure, and I know most people would want the same thing. Let me change the direction a little bit, Maria, to ask you this question. Wherever there are Christians, there's usually not just Orthodox Christians, but there are others. There are Protestants, Baptists, what have you. Tell us about the greater Christian community there, and how is it represented?
The Christian community is very rich in spirituality there. It has a lot of different denominations. The ones that are officially represented are 13 heads of church. So for sure we have many Catholic people, Lutheran people. Of course, the 13 heads of church try to have a loud voice for justice and for peace. So in December 2009, all of the Christian leaders signed a document, the Kairos document, asking for churches around the world to have a loud voice for the atrocities that are happening in Israel and Palestine, and to have a louder voice for their brothers and sisters suffering under Israeli military occupation. But our Christian communities are very rich with many denominations. In my village of Taiba, for example, we have Roman Catholic practice, we have the Greek Orthodox practice, and we also have Melkite practice, which there we call Greek Catholic. Our churches are very important because they run health care centers, schools, and so many Muslim and Christian people are beneficiaries of the things that the church does when they run health centers and schools.
Certainly. Okay. Why would Christians be seen then as a threat? Doesn't make sense to me.
Well, Christians that are there, of course, are of Palestinian ethnicity, and so for the security of Israel, all Palestinians are sort of viewed as terrorists, and we're being
lumped together.
Wiped out. We're being wiped out from the map. If you look at the history since 1948, all of these checkpoints, the wars, the terrible economy, the strangulation, it's meant to clean the community to make way for 100% Jewish homeland. So it's not Christians in particular, but it's Palestinian Christians. But for us, for example, in Jerusalem, I feel that Christianity for 2,000 years has had an amazing witness. We feel our Christian community is small. We're depleting in numbers. Out of the 4 million Palestinians that live in Gaza and the West Bank, we're less than 2% that are Christian, but it's very important to keep our Christian presence there and to witness for the true light of Christ in a land that has had conflict, but especially since 1948 has had the worst conflict because of Israel's aim to make 100% Jewish homeland.
I visited there several times. I've been in Jerusalem, and the one spot that always seems to really to move me is I'll stand and I'll look at the Wailing Wall, a look at the Dome of the Rock, and then the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So we have three major faiths within one another, and yet in the land where peace is preached, peace is never found. And that's so for me as an outsider, let's see, call me a New Yorker, if you will, or call me a United States or an American, I guess that's what I am. I sit back and I say, dear God, when is this going to end? It's just such a shame. Let me ask you this, Maria. Are there any action groups, things that Orthodox Christians are trying to do there now to bring about the peace that we all want?
Well, you know, Father Chris, there's no particular Orthodox groups, but actually we have more Jewish people speaking against what Israel's doing than Christians themselves, because a lot of the evangelical Christians happen to be Christian Zionists, and they support Israel 100% because mm-hmm. of the misinterpretation of the Bible,
that
Israel gains 100% of the land, then the Messiah will return. And of course, Israel is actually us, because we are the new Israel. We are baptized onto Christ, and the church is the new Israel because we've received the Messiah. We were baptized onto Christ. And so this misinterpretation actually leads to this terrible 100% blind support to Israel. And I groups like Jewish Voice for Peace are speaking out to bring more awareness, so in Washington, D.C., there can be more balanced voting when it comes to Israel and to Palestine, because Israel is always brought to the American living room as very near and dear to you, and Palestinians are always brought as terrorists, and that continues to happen. It's okay to spend $8 million each day of taxpayers' money to support this terrible occupation that's happening there.
Okay. Finally, let me ask you this. Are there any online resources for listeners who want to learn more or possibly get involved and help out the situation there?
Well, I think if people want to check out the statistics of what is happening in Israel and in Palestine, If Americans Knew is an organization that keeps tabs on Israel, and I think the Jewish Voice for Peace has a wonderful video that tries to bring about an awareness that Israel needs to be held accountable for all of the human rights violations that are happening on the ground. And for us as Christian people, basically, we want people to come and see with their own eyes what is happening there, and we want people to pray for peace and stability, because all religious groups and everyone can benefit if peace and stability comes to the Holy Land, because, as you said, it's holy. And it's important to many people.
Maria, thank you very much for being with us today, and we wish you and your family all the best. You will definitely be in our prayers.
Those two organizations Dr. Curry mentioned are the Jewish Voice for Peace and If Americans Knew, and we have links to both of those on our website at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. Well, our featured guest today is Professor Aristotle Papanikolaou. He is a co-founder and senior fellow at Fordham's Orthodox Christian Studies Center and the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University. His areas of expertise are Eastern Orthodox theology, Trinitarian theology, and religion in public life. And he's currently developing an expertise on the relation between theological anthropology and violence and virtue ethics, and we caught him on the phone to talk about telling the truth.
Welcome back to the show, Telly.
Thank you, Father Chris. Good to be here.
Telly, what exactly are you talking about when we say truth-telling?
Well, exactly as it says, you know, to tell the truth. But there are various kinds of truths that we tell, and some are a little bit harder to tell than others. I think that I'm speaking about kinds of truths, for the most part, that are really difficult to say. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that they're difficult to say says something about us, says something about things that we fear, says something about our hopes, about how we wish to be perceived, how we wish to present ourselves, what we want people to think of us sometimes. And I do think it's linked to sin. I'm not saying that everything we're afraid to say is necessarily a sin.
Mm-hmm.
But there are often times that the things that we're afraid to speak of somehow are connected to a particular sin that we may have caused, or even a sin that may have been done to us. Sometimes people are afraid to speak about the violence that has been done on them, mm-hmm. Often for fear of what that may mean for their understanding of themselves, for their personal lives, or even they just may, perhaps they don't want to, they don't want people to have a certain kind of image of them because of something that may have been done to them. So.
And one of the things you're looking at, I would understand then, is how truth-telling can illuminate our understandings of sin. Can you explain that a little bit more?
When we're confronting our sin honestly, when we're sort of being honest about ourselves, about the things that we're afraid to speak about, things that maybe we have done, things that maybe have been done to us, I think what we realize as we speak these truths is how much sin works on us in such a way that keeps us from the presence of God. I think we realize that sin is not simply, I break a commandment and somehow I just have to kind of do something which, some kind of contract with God where somehow that command, where that breaking of the law somehow is no longer taken into account. I think we, when we speak the truth, we realize how much something which we've done or maybe we've done to us has been affecting us, has been sort of shaping how we think about things, how we maybe decide to act about certain kinds of things. And I think that there's a certain kind of emotional response that is connected with truth-telling that can be, has potential to be a very kind of liberating force.
How about some examples from Scripture? Do you have any?
Well, I think there's a few, actually. First of all, the example of Peter denying Christ is an example of how our deception, our self-deception, our lack of truth-telling can somehow lead us to feelings of betrayal, feelings of separation from Christ, or even in the act itself, how the act itself can somehow separate us from Christ. And of course, with Peter, we know that something like that was eventually forgiven and reconciled with Christ. So it didn't sort of lead him permanently away from Christ. But we see how sort of an act like that of a deception can lead us far further away. There's the example of the parable of the publican and the Pharisee, where the publican goes in and just simply speaks truthfully to God about what he has done and who he is, and how that in that act of truth-telling, there is an experience of reconciliation and forgiveness, and somehow the Pharisee is sort of the ultimate act of self-deception in a way. Mm-hmm. In the parable of the prodigal son and his truth-telling and coming back to the father and simply just saying, this is what I have done, I'm not going to, deceive you. I mean, this is what I have done, and what I have done is wrong. What's interesting, though, is I also think the story of Adam and Eve has a moment of truth-telling, which I think is or a story or a point about truth-telling, mm-hmm. because they both somehow have betrayed God. And then after the betrayal, God is even asks them, God, the all-knowing one, sort of even asks them, what have you done, right?
Right.
God doesn't say, I know what you've done, you forgot that I'm all-knowing.
Yes,
he says, what have you done?
Right.
And, instead of basically going to God and saying, you're right, I'm so sorry, I've done this, they basically, Adam blames Eve blames the serpent,
yeah.
And somehow they continued through their deception to kind of distance themselves from God, and they, that's what it is. I mean, these kinds of deceptions and lies distance ourselves from God. And, we get thrown out of paradise. And somehow, after that, there is kind of work and struggle and toil and labor to try to work our way back towards a kind of closeness of presence and intimacy with God. So, those are a little bit indirect, right?
Okay.
But in the end, I think, God is truth. And every time we speak truth, I think we connect with God. And another way of putting that is this. I think God meets us where we are, right? And we don't have to be perfect to meet God. God meets us where we are so long as we're truthful about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So somehow a speaking of the truth of ourselves is at one at the same time a moment of connecting ourselves with the truth of God, who is love and forgiveness. And somehow there's some kind of connection there, right?
Okay.
And there's some kind of connection with our speaking truth and ultimately meeting and having an experience of God who is truth.
Well, certainly Adam and Eve were into some truth-stepping. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
In John, I think it's 14:6, Christ says, I am the way,
mm-hmm.
The truth, and the life. Now, how does the idea of Christ as truth affect our understanding then of truth-telling?
Well, I think Christ is the truth. Christ as truth, as the person of Christ, not simply his teachings, but as the very person, is the quintessential embodiment of union with God, right? Mm-hmm. Of the union between ourselves and God, of the union between creation and God, of the union between what is material and bodily in God. And ultimately, Christ represents the truth of what we were created to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that the point that I'm trying to get across in sort of my research and work and writing is that's what truth-telling does. Truth-telling ultimately is an experience of communion with God, or it has that power to be an experience of communion with God. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, what truth-telling does is somehow help us to become like Christ, help us to become like Christ in the sense of participating in the grace and in the life and love of God. What I'm trying to get at really is best expressed through examples, I think. One example is there was a man who recently wrote a book about his father, and his father was in World War II, and they had a very rocky relationship, but eventually they went on a tour of the battle sites that he went on, his father, at an older age. And the father stood in Italy on one of the battle sites and really kind of zoned out and basically was saying, all he could say was, I killed so many people, I killed so many people. Now, he is a World War II veteran on the winning side, fully justified war against Hitler, who seemed to be a madman, right? No sense of doubt there. But yet, even being on the winning side, somehow he'd been carrying for 40-plus years this sense of real guilt and trouble and disturbance about the fact that he killed people, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And somehow on this battlefield, he just spoke that truth. He spoke that, and he turned to his son, and he said, you know, I never said that before to anyone after 40 years. And he was, you know, as he was saying, he was in tears, he was emotional. So somehow, you know, his body, his soul had a need to sort of speak the fact that, you know, he killed people.
Yes.
And even if he was on the winning side, right. You know, he didn't, something about that was weighing down on him his whole life. And connected to this same story, they had a very bad relationship, the father and son, and eventually was healed. The way it was healed was that the father, when he came back from the war, first met his son. The son was born while the father was had to go away to the war. So he met his son, 2 years old. The son, of course, naturally didn't really know who he was and was sort of scared when he first saw him. After that, the relationship was fairly rocky, and so they had a conversation, and the son finally asked and said, Dad, what did you want me to do when you came home? And you know what the father said? Very simple truth. The father said, all I wanted was a hug. And you can tell right then and there, this father experiencing war, experiencing killing, all he really wanted was a hug. He wanted that sense of just embrace and purity and touch. And you know what the son said? The son said, after I heard that, it was like 40 years.
Wow.
40 years, he said, just because of that one truth, because of 40 years of bitterness and resentment, all those things just came washing away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing that truth-telling has the power to do. It has the power to have that power of forgiveness. It has that power of reconciliation. It has that power of and all that stuff there, now that father and son together having that experience, that's where God is. That's where the grace of God is. That, to me, is the presence of God there.
Certainly it is. Finally, Telly, we know in John 8:32, it reads, all ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How does that verse fit into your studies?
I'm, you know, the one thing that we cannot see is the truth simply as a bunch of statements. The creed is the truth, and we recite the creed. But in the end, God is a living God. And truth is a way of being in the world. That's what the great theologians of our 20th century have really uncovered for us in terms of the fathers, the writings of the fathers. They're trying to hammer home that when you come to truth, it's not just a bunch of statements. It is statements, of course. It is. God exists. That is a truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is a way of being. God is a living God. And to be truth is to be like who God is, to be loving and forgiving and caring and to be that kind of force in the world, right? And I'm absolutely convinced that in our struggle to be like God, in our struggle to experience God more and more in our lives, in addition to fasting and prayer and so many other kinds of things that the Church recommends, that just simply being honest, trying as hard as we can, even though it's a very fearful thing, just being honest about ourselves, about who we are, about what we've done. I've heard somebody say that sometimes we spend our entire life accumulating or spending money we don't have to buy things we don't need in order to impress people we don't like.
That's right.
You know,
I
mean, there's that falsity sometimes to life. There's that masking. There's that sense of always trying to feel that we need to present ourselves in a certain way. There's that fear of what people might think of us. And I think that it's just so liberating to just let go of all of that.
Be yourself
in
truth.
Be genuine and authentic in the world. And I think that that genuine kind of being in the world, that authenticity, is simultaneously, I think, an experience of the grace of God. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Well, Telly, it's been a fascinating interview with you. Listeners, to hear other interviews with Dr. Aristotle and Papa Nicolau, and to purchase books he's contributed to, please visit us online at myocn.net. Thank you again, Telly.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Father.
You've been listening to another edition of Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm Mike Trout. Our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos, and thanks as always to our executive producer, Ann Dankert. We're a nonprofit outreach, and you can join with us financially. We would appreciate that so very much. There is a Donate Now button on our home site. You can give safely when you go to that site at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. We'll be back next week with another edition of the broadcast. Tell your friends about us. You're the best promotional tool we have. And remember to always have faith in what you listen to.